You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 7th of June 2023 on Monocle Radio.
Ukraine begins mopping up, the current state of the US-UK relationship, and a new assessment of which cities expats are paying the most rent. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Nardine Batchelor-Hunt and Stephen DL will discuss the day's big stories. We'll have the latest on Canada's wildfires from our Toronto correspondent, and we'll introduce a new celebration of film, the medium and the material. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I'm joined today by Nardine Batchelor-Hunt, a political reporter for Politics Home, and by Stephen DL, the writer, broadcaster, and Russia analyst. We will have more from both of you shortly. But first, for a period last night, the cities with the worst air quality in the world were New York and Toronto. The consequence of wildfires rampaging across Canada, Quebec is especially badly affected, with at least 160 fires blazing. Well, let's get the latest now with Thomas Lewis, Monocle's Toronto correspondent. Thomas, what is it like in Toronto now?
We're pretty hazy still, Andrew, today. It is lunchtime here. And yesterday, people woke up not really quite sure why the air was so watery and the visibility was so poor. It was quite a sight to see the CN Tower in the distance and the skyscrapers that surround it just essentially shrouded in this yellowy brown smog. And we are expecting that here in Toronto, at least, to continue into the weekend. As you mentioned in the introduction, cities like New York, Washington, D.C., Detroit have also had incredibly poor air quality. And there are some advisories that are going around in all of those cities. For example, here in parts of Ontario, they're suggesting that all outdoor activities for school children, for example, be cancelled. So things like break time are being held indoors. And people are also being advised, especially if you have conditions like asthma, to be digging out the N95 masks from the drawer somewhere and wearing those if you're going outside, and advising not to do things like exercise during the conditions, given that the particles can be quite damaging, so they say. So it is having quite a large effect, Andrew, over quite a large part of North America at the moment.
I mean, obviously wildfires in Canada are not unheard of, and certainly not at this time of year heading into summer, but are these ones unusual, especially for early June?
They are highly unusual, particularly in the province of Quebec. And it's been this sort of perfect storm, as I've seen it described in some of the newspapers in Montreal today, that they reported, I think, about five wildfires in the province last week, which isn't unusual, as you say, for this time of year. But what is unusual is that number had leapt to about 158 wildfires across the southern swathe of the province by Monday. And given that I think the provincial government has the capacity to fight around 30 wildfires at the same time, given there's, as you say, almost 160 blazing at the moment, the authorities there are really prioritizing those fires that are close to cities, for example, or close to crucial parts of infrastructure. We did have a statement from the Premier of Quebec earlier today, François Legault. He's said that the evacuation orders that are in place in some cities in Quebec, they won't be lifted until next week, and that they are bringing reinforcements in, firefighters and military personnel from places like New Brunswick here in Canada, but also France apparently is going to coordinate part of this firefighting response as well.
The immediate priority obviously is going to be extinguishing these fires, but beyond that, is there going to be or likely to be a wider conversation in Canada about what the early advent of such severe fires may say about progress or not in the realm of dealing with climate change?
Well, I think this is a conversation that has been going for at least the past few years. And of course, a big UN report last year suggested that wildfire seasons could get longer in places like Canada and be more severe. I think at the moment, given that things are pretty sort of national picture here and that fires are being fought right across the country, I think there are about 400 wildfires active from the west, Alberta, British Columbia, over to Quebec, and here in Northern Ontario as well. So I think it will definitely sharpen people's minds, Andrew, as to whether these kind of incidences are going to get more severe in the years to come, as some scientists who've been talking to Canadian radio today, for example, seem to suggest they might.
Thomas Lewis, Monocle's Toronto correspondent, thank you for joining us. We will now continue today's Daily with today's panellists, Nadine Batchelor-Hunt and Stephen Diel, and we'll look at Ukraine. The breaching of the enormous Novokakhovka Dam on the mighty Dnieper River would be a disaster at any time for any reason. In yesterday's circumstances, apparently destroyed deliberately by an invading army, it piles calamity atop catastrophe. Thousands of homes and businesses have been damaged or destroyed on both sides of the river. Tens of thousands of people have required evacuation and uncountable billions of dollars worth of damage done. As we go to air, Russia is continuing to find very few takers for its line that it had nothing to do with the puncturing of the dam, and indeed that it was an act of false flag sabotage by Ukraine. Stephen, first of all, is there any, well, when we start talking about logical reasons why Russia does anything at this point, we are possibly deviating from what the rest of us might consider reality, but is there any reason why Russia would have blown this dam up at this time?
To try and stop the expected Ukrainian offensive, or to try and slow it down at least. Let's be clear, you know, Russia doesn't care what damage it does to Ukraine or Ukrainians. You know, we've seen that ever since the start of this war in February last year, be it individuals who've been raped and tortured and murdered, including civilians, of course, or en masse. This idea that it was the Ukrainians who did it is almost too absurd to address, but we have to because Russia has raised the issue. But the fact that Ukraine, which has already suffered so much in terms of its people and also material damage, to do something like this would make no sense for Ukraine to do this to themselves and cause, as you mentioned, billions of dollars worth of more destruction. But it's little clues, like the fact that Moscow came out so quickly and blamed Ukraine for it with no evidence, giving no evidence and having no evidence. That's a typical ruse that you think, okay, it's rather like they did with MH17, you know, denying that they'd shot it down when everyone knows they did. So if it weren't so serious, it would just be absurd, the Russian stance. They've done it simply to hold up the expected Ukrainian counteroffensive, I think. And if it causes more damage to Ukraine, then so be it. They don't care about that.
Nadine, not that it would exculpate Russia even slightly, because to be clear, this dam is in the part of Ukraine that Russia occupies. There is another theory doing the rounds that Russia may have done this sort of by accident. Satellite imagery of the dam from a few days ago does suggest that some damage had already been done to it. Whether that was deliberately by Russia, accidentally by Russia, or as a consequence of Russia failing to maintain it. But Russia's response to this, possibly deliberately, does look as if they were almost as surprised as anybody else.
I mean, it wouldn't be a huge surprise if it was, you know, accidental. The Russians did this accidentally because the invasion and the war in Ukraine has been quite chaotic on the Russian side. I mean, I remember going to briefings in the early days of what was happening with Western officials, as we had to call them. But they were saying, you know, it's not going to plan. It's extremely chaotic. The information on the ground that commanders are getting from troops, etc., it's just disorganised. So it would be pretty on brand if they'd accidentally blown up a massive piece of infrastructure. But also we have to remember that, you know, if it is intentional, which it may be, there's, you know, even Rishi Sunak is reluctant at the moment to say whether or not it was. Destroying a nation's infrastructure is a key part of invading their country. It's a key part of trying to kind of weaken them to make them easier to kind of dominate and conquer for intents and purposes. So it wouldn't be a huge surprise. But again, as you said, it's somewhere that Russia's seeking to occupy, so it doesn't really make much sense. But as you said at the beginning, a lot of things Russia does doesn't really make sense. So you just have to try and do guesswork to work out exactly what's going through their head on a given day or hour.
Well, indeed. So, Stephen, it's an unpleasant thought, but it is one that has been raised before now, people suggesting that in the event of the war going terminally badly for Russia, and even Russia starting to understand that they really have screwed this up and that they cannot win, is there a danger, and could this demolition of the dam be part of it, that Russia could just go full Gotterdammerung, just do that thing, and it would not be the first time that Russia has done it, just thought, well, if we cannot take it, we will destroy it?
I wouldn't be surprised at all, I'm sorry to say. It seems that from the start, instructions were given to troops to maraud, to rape, to pillage, literally. Look at Bucha. And since then, we've seen a number of other examples. Look at the way Mariupol, a modern, vibrant city, has effectively been wiped off the face of the earth. And Russia has history on this, Aleppo, Grozny in Chechnya. So that's entirely possible. One of my thoughts when I heard about this yesterday morning was that, of course, the nuclear plant at Zaporizhia, which is upriver, is possibly going to be affected. And it struck me that one reason why Russia hasn't actually blown that up is because it's so close to the Russian border and they don't know which way the wind would be blowing. Because, of course, both Russia and Ukraine remember the experience of 1986 and Chernobyl. And most of the radioactive dust was carried westward across Europe. But if the winds are going the other way, then you could have an awful lot of radioactivity blowing into Russia. So that to me, I'm sure it's something they've considered, but they've thought, actually, this is a bit too close to us. We might suffer more. Of course, this incident does put extra strain on Zaporizhia, on the nuclear plant, although it's not operating. And obviously, the IAEA are keeping a close eye on that. They don't seem to think it's under too much threat at the moment, but it's certainly not good news for that either. But Russia will deliberately do as much damage as it can.
Just a final thought on this one, Nadine, and it is about Russia's, let's call it, idiosyncratic approach to public messaging at a moment like this. It's not the first time that Russia has stood up and proudly announced that 2 + 2 = 5 or 28 or Q, or whatever it is that Russia has decided 2 + 2 = But even by their standards, TASS, the Russian news agency, taking issue with the story that has been doing the rounds, that there's been large numbers of animals drowned at the Novikakova Zoo. TASS reporting a Novikakova emergency services worker, presumably attached to the occupying Russian administration, saying this can't be true because the city has no zoo. But the city zoo is right there on Google Maps. It has 4.7 stars on Google reviews. What is the mileage in just standing up and saying something which obviously isn't true and can be demonstrated obviously isn't true by anybody with a laptop and 3 seconds to spare?
I mean, the entire justification for invading Ukraine was kind of that on a massive scale. Like, they kind of, I feel like, you know, sometimes it's those small absurdities, like saying there isn't a zoo when there obviously is one, that reminds you of how absurd this entire situation was. I mean, Putin was meeting with, you know, Liz Truss when she was foreign secretary, and various foreign officials literally the days before, saying, well, there's no way we're going to invade Ukraine. You people are crazy. And then lo and behold, we're, you know, a year and a half deep or whatever into the war. So the truth doesn't really matter to, you know, the Kremlin, to Putin. You just say what you want to say, whether the facts agree or not. And I also do think we saw, obviously not on the same scale, but with Trump as well, this populism, just say things that objectively are fake, like you won an election, and just accept that. It's a kind of, unfortunately, a kind of symptom of modern media and comms. But, you know, yeah, this seems like quite a kind of whimsical example of how ridiculous things have become.
Well, let's look now to the latest developments in the long-standing diplomatic partnership between the United Kingdom and the United States, which the United Kingdom fondly refers to as the special relationship, rather more frequently than the United States does. UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is visiting Washington, D.C., and President Joe Biden. Their meeting tomorrow will be their fourth this year, which says something about the teetering nature of both their intrays, but it won't just be about Ukraine. Sunak also wishes to address the implications of Biden's immense Inflation Reduction Reduction Act, which has struck many as remarkably bracing America firstism. Stephen, we have been accustomed to thinking of Joe Biden as a return to normality after 4 years of Donald Trump, and in many respects, obviously he is. But because of that, have we overlooked the fact or the degree to which Biden is himself something of an America firster?
Which any people would expect their leader to think first about.
I'm not saying it's necessarily an unreasonable thing for a president of the United States to be.
No, no political party or individual ever won an election on foreign policy. It's domestic policy that counts, and he knows. I mean, America, with its history, is actually in a bit of a bad way at the moment economically, and he has to show people, particularly because he's got one eye on next year's election already, that in fact under his leadership that America can be not made great again. I don't think he'd use that phrase, but that things can be sorted out, and we're post-pandemic and everything else. But what I found particularly amusing was more actually Sunak's approach that, we're going to talk about trade. Sunak and his party having screwed up Britain's trade arrangements by leaving the European Union. I was going to use a phrase there that perhaps wasn't proper radio, that you upset your nearest neighbours by leaving the bloc with them, and therefore you try and find neighbours, trading partners elsewhere. So you go across the Atlantic, across the pond, and you say, we're all friends, we've got this great relationship, which Biden's might not necessarily agree with too closely.
Well, indeed not. And Biden is, of course, Nadine, not the only person involved in these discussions who may well be thinking about an election next year. What does Rishi Sunak want from this visit? Not so much with Ukraine. I think we can probably fairly see that they are in agreement on that. But in terms of trade in particular?
I think, Nigel Farage, I think it was late last month, even went on television and said, Brexit's failed. It's not been a success. Now, going into the next election, the Tories, their key, their kind of trump card at the last election was, we will get Brexit done. And then they said, we have got Brexit done. When you've got the kind of poster boy who started off the momentum, but, really put it into overdrive, in the 2014, 2015, to get this referendum on the table, to get us out of the EU, when he says it's going badly, it's not good when you want to go to the electorate and say, we delivered what you wanted, but the poster boy said it's bad. So he's got to try and secure a trade agreement with America, which America doesn't seem to want to do, and also present himself as prime ministerial, as a diplomat, as, somebody who can be respected on the world stage. And a lot of it is to do, as you rightly said, with next year's election. And, even at home, the stop the boats rhetoric, I think there was recently an EU, some sort of EU summit where Rishi Sunak's, one of the briefing was, he's going to emphasise as a priority the importance of stopping the boats. It's like, I'm pretty sure European leaders are not overly obsessed with boats crossing from Calais to the UK. So it's all very much about like building this image, trying to, make Brexit work, etc. And obviously pushing this special relationship, because as you say, with this this Inflation Reduction Act, it's going to have a wide-reaching impact, particularly for little countries that aren't in the EU.
One thing that Rishi Sunak is particularly good at doing is stating the obvious and trying to pretend that it's something remarkable, or rather like when the deal came, it was done over Northern Ireland recently, and he said, no, they've got the best of both worlds. They can trade with the United Kingdom, they can trade with Europe. Oh, yes, like we all had when we were in the European Union. And one of these, he gave a press conference on his plane going over, and I love this way he was talking about it. In offshore wind, we're a global leader, not just Britain, this is okay, the UK, United Kingdom, not just the first, but the second, third, and fourth largest offshore wind farms are all in the UK. That might be because we're an island and have one or two other islands, and have a coastline of nearly 31,500 kilometres. Now, of European countries, France has 5,500 kilometres. A bit of a difference. We have the coastline to have these wind farms. So it's not saying that we're so wonderful because we've got the technology. We've just got the geography.
Is it not, though, just to follow that up and not necessarily wishing to sound like I am a paid shill for Rishi Sunak. I'm merely at this point being an unpaid shill for Rishi Sunak. But is it not actually there, nonetheless encouraging to hear a Conservative Prime Minister bigging up renewable energy and wind farms? Because he knows very well that for quite a lot of his base, that is not going to play at all.
Well, he's got to, you know, maybe it's a straw he's got to clutch at because there's not a lot else going for him.
Well, indeed not. Nadine, also on this, I did want to ask for your view on a bit of, well, this is a peculiarly American bit of political theatre. There was talk that Rishi Sunak would throw out the first pitch at a baseball game, specifically between the Washington Nationals and the Arizona Diamondbacks. This is a very weird thing they do in baseball, of just inviting some rando celebrity out onto the mound before the game. It's not really part of the game. It is just somebody throwing a ball from the mound to the catcher. But it does occasion great hilarity when it goes somewhat askew, as it often does. Politicians often having become politicians to get back at the people who didn't pick them for the sports teams at school. They're trying to spin this Rishi Sunak's team by saying this was never actually going to happen. He wasn't ever invited to do it. Do we believe that?
No, I imagine somebody in his comms team were like, what the hell? Absolutely not. Like, it reminds me a little bit of when that video, he posted that video on social media of them in the back of a car with that seatbelt on and someone's recording him, and you're thinking, you have people paid hundreds of thousands of pounds to be your special advisors. Not one of them thought, it's probably not worth posting a video of him without a seatbelt on Instagram when very few people on Instagram are probably going to watch it or be politically engaged by the Prime Minister in the back of a car. Like, so I imagine somebody said, you know, that's not a good idea. Let's just can that. But yeah, I mean, and if I were his press advisor, I'd be like, no, you're not some kind of celebrity. You're a Prime Minister of a country and we don't want you to see you throwing baseballs.
Well, let's move along to France. And notwithstanding France's recent redoubtable support for NATO's assistance to Ukraine, France has long had a somewhat fractious relationship with the alliance. Between 1966 and 2009, indeed, France withdrew from NATO's military command structure. What started as a harumph by Charles de Gaulle evolving into a three-decade sulk. France is now responding with the diplomatic equivalent of a mournful air on a tiny accordion to suggestions of a NATO liaison office in Japan. President Emmanuel Macron has said it would be a big mistake, possibly while enacting a fatalistic shrug. Nadine, always delighted, by the way, that the French just live up to absolutely every stereotype the rest of us enjoy nurturing of them. Also, a quote from a French official, and I can't do the accent justice, but you can imagine how he said this, that NATO stands for North Atlantic. It's fabulous stuff, isn't it?
It is. And to be fair to the French, I do see where they're coming from. You know, in some ways, one could argue if they do start expanding that way, then Putin can say, look, I told you, they're expanding. They're trying to become this like global massive entity or whatever, which they already are, to be honest, whether or not Japan has a NATO office there feels a bit by the by. But I understand why France have that scepticism. And I think it's healthy to have that within the bloc. It's healthy to have kind of one of the major countries within NATO saying, hang on a minute, is this a good idea? I think it's an example of them kind of checking each other, and whether or not, you know, it'll have any sort of impact, I imagine it will. But no, I, you know, if I was going to talk about what my personal view is on that, I think France are being quite sensible there. It's not something that we should kind of be nonchalant about or, you know, not think too much about.
Well, France's case, Stephen, is essentially that if NATO does wish to interact with Japan at any level, there are any number of embassies of NATO powers in Tokyo, and it's not like everybody doesn't have, you know, phones and email and so forth. And I think possibly France is somewhat mindful that this would not be met with outpourings of great joy in Beijing. Indeed, China's foreign ministry spokesman has said, we have seen NATO bent on going east into this region, interfering in regional affairs and inciting bloc confrontation. Is there a point here, similar to what Nadine suggested, that this would be stirring up a lot of avoidable hassle for no really obvious gain?
No, I don't think there would be. 27 years ago, I think it was, NATO opened an office in Moscow.
How'd that go?
Well, at first it was okay. Then after the bombing of Belgrade, the Russians shut it down. But then it was opened up again. And it was open for about 20 years after that. So it was a way of making sure that there was communication with the Russians up to the point where the Russians stopped talking to NATO. But, you know, if we were talking here about opening talks with Japan to join NATO, then I could understand the French concerns. But we're talking about having a liaison office. And yes, there are embassies there, but actually, you know, NATO does its own diplomacy as well. Let's be realistic. You know, the world is a strange place at the moment, and there are reasons for the West to be concerned about what's happening in the Far East, particularly with China. And it strikes me that the Chinese comments you just quoted sounded rather like sort of Russian moans about, it's not fair. I don't see why a NATO liaison office in Japan, presumably in Tokyo, would be any threat to the security of the region. It would just mean that Japan, which is recognised by everyone as part of the West, even if geographically it's not, and is a member of G7 and so on, I don't see any problem with this at all.
At last summer's NATO summit in Madrid, Nadine, for the first time, the leaders of Japan, South Korea, Australia and New Zealand were invited. China was mentioned in NATO's strategic concept for the first time. Regular listeners to Monocle Radio's The Foreign Desk, like there are any other kind, will recall that last October we had Jens Stoltenberg on as a guest, and I vaguely pitched him the idea that one day these four countries could join NATO, because we have been hearing for 18 months now that this is an alliance of values, not merely geography. Is that necessarily a completely fantastic idea? Because the security concerns of the North Atlantic and Europe are not really any more detached from the security concerns of the Pacific, are they?
I feel like in an increasingly globalised world, it does feel quite arbitrary to have this kind of line where it's like, oh, you're on this top part of the world, so you are here, and then you can't be part of it. And also when already Australia already has some sort of kind of like, you know, it has a strong relationship with NATO as it is. You know, it's not like they're not in the room when important discussions are being held. So I wouldn't be surprised if NATO does become a joint of kind of values over geography. But I also, going back to the office situation with NATO office, I agree in principle it's an office. But I think what it would represent within the context of what's happening in Ukraine as well, I can see why it would almost be a gift, as you say, to China to do that in the current context. If it was, you know, there wasn't a war and Putin wasn't saying all this stuff about NATO, probably wouldn't feel as charged. But I think the way that it is at the moment, I think, you know, it gives them something to complain about.
Well, let's move along and offer some commiserations at this point to any non-American listeners enjoying today's show in New York. According to the latest edition of ECA International's cost of living rankings, you are living in Earth's most expensive city for expats. New York has knocked Hong Kong off the top spot, the other minor placings filled for the second year running by Geneva and London. Stephen, first of all, beyond Geneva and London, we have Singapore, Zurich, San Francisco, Tel Aviv, Seoul and Tokyo. Do any of these listings surprise you? It's pretty much who you'd expect, isn't it?
It is.
It's the usual suspects.
Yeah. And, as someone who is a resident rather than an expat living in London, I tend to think, well, who are these, expats? They, you could class them, a refugee nowadays could be an expat. I presume they're thinking of, as it's Bloomberg put it out, high-end earners who actually are going to be probably less affected by inflation in the country they're in, and if their rent's gone up a bit, well, they can probably afford it. So I'm rather cynical about these. But as you say, New York and Hong Kong have swapped places. London is still number four, and as a resident of London, I can understand why. Although, I have to say, when I was very surprised when I was in the States, and not in New York, but in Denver and Houston earlier this year, and I was quite surprised, I was very surprised by the fact that food was decidedly more expensive than it is in London, in both of those cities.
That does surprise me. That has not usually been the case where the United States is concerned. Nadine, I guess any resident of any of these cities does at some point end up wondering, is this all worth it? How do you calibrate the point at which whatever you're paying in terms of rent, mortgage, other expenses is actually offset by the bounty before you, whether it is economic, cultural or whatever?
It's actually funny you should say that, because I've been thinking about that a lot recently. London is just cripplingly expensive, particularly if you're my age, and the idea, I'm in my late 20s, and the idea that I'll ever be able to buy a house is just fantasy in the capital. So it does get to a point, I think, a tipping point where you have to make a decision. Are you going to be happy here long term? Do you want to raise a family in somewhere that's so expensive? Is it possible really to raise a family in a healthy environment like this when, you know, there's pollution as well? That's another thing we need to add to the mix. So it is depressing in seeing how these major cities are getting more and more expensive. And really, the preserves of the elite, you know, if you don't have a lot of money, you can't really thrive in London really now. You just get pushed more and more out. So yeah, it's something I've been thinking about a lot about recently, probably partially because of the cost of living crisis as well. But you know, maybe London's not for me, and maybe, you know, in the next 5 or 10 years you'll find me in Manchester or something.
Well, I did want to close today's panel's deliberations by asking you each in turn, and I'll ask you first, Nadine, where would you exile or expat yourself to?
Would it have to be national or international?
Anywhere you like. The world is your oyster.
Manchester. we probably would be Manchester. I'm from Birmingham, and I, as much as I love Birmingham, it's just not for me. So I think it would be Manchester if it was the UK. If it was internationally, I do really like Tel Aviv.
Stephen, where would you exile yourself to?
Well, I should point out that I love London, and I love the fact that there's always so much to do in London, and perhaps it's because I'm a lot older, and perhaps that's why I can afford it. if I were forced out, my place of choice would be the Highlands of Scotland, because that's where I feel at home, and that's just wonderful. But if I were really pushed and I had to go abroad, it would either be Berlin or Barcelona. I just love both places.
Stephen Diel and Nadine Batchelor-Hunt, thank you both for joining us. Finally, on today's show, we are turning to film. In our modern era, digital technologies have revolutionised the way we watch and restore film. But new technology doesn't always capture the magic of watching film in its original format, which is, clue in the name, film. From the 8th to the 11th of this month, the BFI South Bank in London is hosting its inaugural Film on Film Festival, which looks to celebrate the history of cinema in all its glory. Monocle's Monica Lillis spoke to Robin Baker, head curator of the BFI National Archive and the programme director of the festival, to find out more about the event.
We're celebrating the joy that is real film. So imagine bits of celluloid going through a projector with sprocket holes. Over a long weekend, so it runs from the 8th to the 11th of June at BFI South Bank. And the reason for doing it is many of us grew up in an age when all films in cinemas were projected from pieces of film. Then suddenly at the start of this century, around about 2005 in the UK, film was phased out, digital brought in. Now, that sounds like a slightly dull technological revolution, but the reality is the two look not the same. So you might be watching the same film, but it will look and sound different. So we felt it was really important to give people the opportunity to see films as the directors would have first imagined them, how audiences would first have seen them. So it's taking you back to something, I'd say, a little more authentic.
What is the visual difference that we could see if we're watching something on digital as opposed to watching it on film?
There are a number of differences. Firstly, digital will be brighter, tends to be more contrasty. You'll notice there's absolutely no movement in the picture in digital because the image will have been stabilised and it's not a piece of physical film running through a film. There'll be no flicker that you'd get from a projector. The colours will look different. The giveaway usually is the colour of bright red, which looks very different in the digital world. And then also when film is shot and created, when it's processed, it will have all kinds of grain in it. When that goes into the digital world, the grain goes with it, and it looks very different. It looks very kind of buzzy on screen. So you're getting multiple changes, and at the same time, there are all those things that are almost imperceivable, like the flicker coming from the projector, like the sound of real changes. So you're getting a whole range of things that might be very small, but they are different to how it would have been originally seen.
Why did you choose this particular selection of films to show?
We chose them for a number of reasons. I mean, they could be simply, you know, with the issue of Jaws, fantastic film, an amazing print of a fantastic film. So why not show that? I was really interested in exploring the many and various kind of film formats. It's pretty rare to see original prints of 70mm, which is the huge gauge film that lots of epics were shot in. And so we're showing Far and Away with Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman, looking absolutely spectacular in a way that it cannot look on digital.
Tell me you like my hat.
You're not wearing a hat.
Say it. Say you like my hat.
You're not wearing a hat.
Say it.
We're looking at those experiences like giving people opportunity to watch original 1950s 3D, where the film, in fact, it's two pieces of film, are projected simultaneously. The projectors are interlaced, they're connected to each other, so these two prints being screened simultaneously while you wear your polarized glasses. That is a really rare experience. For me, one of the most exciting things we're doing is showing films on original nitrate film prints. Nitrate was the base of the film on which all 35mm was shot, projected before 1950. When you project it, it looks different. It's more lustrous. The black and whites are kind of deeper. But it's a really, really dangerous format. It's highly flammable. It decomposes very quickly. And BFI South Bank is the only public cinema in the UK able to screen it. So we're giving people in the UK the first opportunity for, I think, about 12 years to see nitrate prints projected.
How do you think we could make shooting on film more accessible, or is it just not really possible in a digital age?
Until the cost of film stock comes down, it's going to be increasingly difficult. What I do think is there are so many contemporary filmmakers working with film, and not just the kind of Christopher Nolans, Wes Andersons, Paul Thomas Andersons of this world, but people working on a kind of smaller budgets. I think there are enough directors right now and cinematographers who absolutely understand the importance of the aesthetic differences. You know, I'm not interested in a world where suddenly we all go back to shooting everything on film. Digital's got its own sense of fantastic aesthetics. There are all kinds of things you can achieve with digital that you can't achieve with film. I just want us to be in that rich world where we can embrace both, and that filmmakers can have a vision that could embrace either. I think, again, the further we get away from the analogue world, more and more people want to really kind of embrace its possibilities, its complexities, some of its failings even, and really celebrate that kind of richness of what they can achieve with it as part of their own artistic practice as much as anything.
What do you hope the outcome of this event will be?
I think the biggest desire I've always had for this festival is that it helps push further a kind of national and partly an international debate about why film is great, why we shouldn't turn our back on it, why the medium itself, it's not just about, it's not just for kind of carrying the information, the picture of the film, the sound of the film. It's bigger than that. It's got more about it. And I think just kind of being able to encourage, help other people to see that, give people opportunities to see it, and to have a discussion where we don't just say, sit back and go, yeah, digital and analog film exactly the same, because they're not. So it's about helping people understand, helping people to see, and to have that discussion around it. And I think if we have that plurality of film types in the future, we have a richer, more invigorating world of cinema. And surely that's the place we all want to be.
Thanks to Monica Lillis for that report. That is all for this edition of The Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Nadine Batchelor-Hunt and Stephen Diel. Also to Thomas Lewis in Toronto. And a big shout out to Euston Blue Watch of the London Fire Brigade. Special guests at Midori House this afternoon. And the reason our associate publisher is no longer incarcerated in a malfunctioning lift. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello. Our sound engineer was Tamsin Howard. I'm Andrew Muller in London. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.